Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, presented today by our friends at Vistaprint. The Warriors even up the series with a blowout against the Thunder in Game 2. Jeff Hornacek has been hired, or will be hired imminently, as New York Knicks head coach in what is a rather surprising development. Get a little bit more news as well on some opt-outs and contracts. And then also starting a new feature, we're going to be going through our free agent rankings by position. Today we are doing the point guard. Danny LaRue joins me for the duration.
So after at game one at halftime, I kind of had an expectation of how the rest of the game was going to go. And it certainly didn't happen. Full credit to the Oklahoma City Thunder. What happened in game two was what I expected to happen in game one.
Yeah, it's interesting. And to me, the biggest takeaway from this one was I thought the Thunder actually played relatively well in the first half. If they hadn't gotten killed on the offensive glass, they gave up 43% offensive rebounds and then another five team rebounds where an offensive rebound went out of bounds and was awarded to the Warriors. A couple of those were block shots, but still, the defense was good. The Warriors seemed to be flummoxed by their length. They weren't, Steph and Clay weren't doing a ton, and the other guys were being made to beat them, and they were to some extent, but Steven Adams and to a lesser extent Serge Ibaka were really causing big time trouble for the Warriors in the paint, and you could tell that they didn't have their flow. They were kind of thinking about things, even though they did score very efficiently, in large part due to those offensive rebounds and getting into the free throw line. The Thunder defense completely collapsed in the third quarter, though.
Yeah, and Stephen Curry had 17 points. That was a big part of it, especially when you consider, I think Clay went 1-for-4 in that third quarter. And a lot of those were just open shots that you do not expect him to get against a team that is clearly focusing on him.
Yeah, and what's been so good about the Thunder is when they've switched out on screening action for Curry, their communication has been excellent, and that's what we focused on going into this series, that this is a team that struggled with their communication throughout the year. The Spurs, while they defended them very well after game one, the Spurs did not put a ton of pressure on them with their shooting, with their decision making throughout the entire length of the shot clock. And for whatever reason, and I didn't even think the Thunder had that many mistakes in the first, they at least were forcing them to drive. I mean, that's the number one thing, is you got to run those guys off the 3-point line, and then they trust their length at the rim. And in this one, they were just letting Steph get wide open threes, just, you know, like it was a midseason game against the Phoenix Suns. And, you know, it was just mistake after mistake, and not something they can get away with. It only cost them one game. You know, it doesn't matter whether you win by one or by 20, but this is kind of the Thunder team that we saw during the year, and that caused me to pick the Warriors in five games, because I wasn't sure that they could keep up and be consistent defensively. And we've seen the good Thunder on defense, and we've seen the bad Thunder on defense.
A big part of the good Thunder on defense is Steven Adams, who has done a great job in this series, and I thought he fought pretty hard through just a rough physical stretch. Festus Ezeli put his whole body weight on Adams' lower back, and he basically stayed in the game. He went out briefly and came back, and then he got, from what I could tell, he got something like getting kneed in the Kiwis by Draymond Green. Still kept on playing, still did a pretty good job, and was really dissuading the Warriors at the rim. And Golden State is, they do penetrate well. It's what happens when you have shooters. But when you don't chase them off the line, the fact that they don't get to the free throw line most of the time doesn't matter as much, because they're just hitting their threes.
So I went back and watched that third quarter where Steph just went completely crazy, scoring, I think, 15 points in like a 2-minute stretch. And that third quarter was the perfect storm of, number one, the Warriors just not guarding Robertson whatsoever. They started off with Draymond Green on him. Then it was Bogut on him for a time as well. And I mean, there was one absolutely comical play in the third where the Thunder were about to run some play. Robertson was in the corner. They threw it to him, and pretty much everyone on Golden State had their back to him, and he just missed a corner three anyway. He had a couple of other drives off of passes, one an amazing finish, another one because, you know, his man Bogut can just stand under the rim or Green, and then he still has to finish over that length. You know, he's not going to pull up for a mid-ranger or shoot a floater, or he's got to just shoot that three. And the problem, too, for the Thunder is they don't have the ball movement, they don't have the shooters like Golden State was. Like, you know, it's not like Robertson can shoot any better than Bogut can. It's just that Golden State's flow enables Bogut to get the ball in situations where he can screen for their great shooters, get them open, whereas everything Oklahoma City is doing is totally predictable. And so if there's someone who is, if Robertson goes to screen for someone, whoever's guarding him can then get out there in time. So it's really, you know, that's kind of the difference, because Oklahoma City does not have that level of offensive sophistication, why it's so easy to leave him where maybe it's not for total non-shooters on other teams.
And also with where Draymond, when he's playing free safety, is occupying the floor, a lot of what OKC is doing when they use Robertson as a screener is trying to open up a guy like Westbrook or Durant in the center of the floor. So you're basically leading them right to where Draymond can be. So he doesn't even have to react to the initial action. He can just react to where it's going. And if they maybe if they started doing that to take Durant to the corner, that might work a little bit better. But even then, I mean, it's still going to be problematic. And yeah, I think that there was a lot in this game that should concern Oklahoma City. Of course, their defense can be better than it was in the third quarter. But just because I think that though there's this running thing, I think Tim Kawakami articulated best so far, which is that when the Warriors figure a team out, it gets really, they struggle and they usually win the series. That's what happened against Memphis and Houston last year and Cleveland. I don't think they've gotten all the way there with the Thunder, but I think that they have the ideas and the kind of the concepts in place. And now they have a couple of days off for both teams, which I think really helps the Warriors more than the Thunder.
Yeah, allowing Steph to get even healthier than he was. I actually, while this was obviously a step in the right direction for him with some of the plays he made, he's still not a ton of plays with burst. He had one where he blew past Steven Adams and there wasn't any help. That was another big problem for the Thunder, by the way, is that when their bigs got out on an island against Klay and Steph, there just was not help, even against kind of shooting challenge lineups where they should have been helping off. So we'll see for Steph whether he really is all the way back. I don't think the Thunder defense was so bad on him in this game that I think it's hard to necessarily conclude that he is there. But he does seem to be improving, and he had more verve moving off the ball. So let's run through some of these important possessions in the third that really kind of show what the issues were for the Thunder. I mean, pretty much every offensive possession, Draymond Green, if he was guarding Robertson, was just standing at the free throw line. So you imagine KD trying to ISO up top. His man can get right into him knowing that there's help coming, so you can't get a clean shot off for a jumper. And then if you try to drive, you're just going to run right into Draymond. And KD was asked why he only took two shots after having 25, I think, in the first half. And here's what he had to say.
Eric Horn with the Oklahoman. Kevin, you had 25 points in the first half, but you only had two shot attempts in that third quarter. What was going on in that third quarter exactly that limited your shot attempts that the Warriors were being successful at?
Well, they were sending three guys, you know, and I just tried to make the right pass, and I was turning the ball over, you know, playing in the crowd, you know, so maybe I just got to shoot over three people.
So yeah, definitely a little frustration there from KD, an interesting comment, and I think that sort of goes right to the Robertson issue, frankly, and the issue with some of the other guys who really weren't able to take advantage, although part of the reason they aren't able to take advantage is because the Thunder don't move the ball enough to where those guys can get opening, and it's all very predictable.
And that gets into the idea of expectations, is that one of the big things with the Warriors is that now, and this was a big problem in game one, but usually when they get a look, they realize they can do better, but Oklahoma City just doesn't have that ingrained in them from the Scott Brooks days or now, that they can, you know, fight and use that to get something better, and part of that's because there just isn't enough going on.
Here are some of the defensive possessions in the third quarter for Oklahoma City. The Warriors found success running a double high set, although not quite as high out on the floor as it often is, because I think what they wanted to be able to do was shorten the passing distance to the roll man so that he actually could make the catch if there was a double team or a switch right near the basket. So an early play, they ran that, Bogut rolled to the rim, Curry just hit him when Adams switched out, and then Russ, I guess, didn't switch on to Bogut. I wasn't sure whether there's supposed to be a hedge or a switch or what, but whatever it was, they didn't execute it. And then Serge Ibaka was on the weak side, just didn't come over at all on Bogut, and he just got a wide open dunk. So that was one. Then the Curry three-pointers. One of them was in transition. This is the one where he got followed by Durant, and Durant got the tee. Durant did a great job to block his layup in transition, and then he was still on him. They were both on the ground, and Curry just got up and ran to the corner, and KD just wasn't even paying attention. He got out there late and followed him. It was a questionable call, but still he let him get a wide-open three that was just lucky that he missed. And that maybe got him going a little bit, although I don't want to say that because he also just got wide-open shots right afterwards. And then the next time, there was a Russ Ibaka switch on Curry with 18 on the shot clock, and then Bogut just screened for Steph. Steven Adams didn't switch. I mean, if you're going to switch Ibaka onto Steph, he's not going to get through a down screen by Andrew Bogut. He's too big. He's too clumsy. You have to, again, switch with Adams. He just didn't do it. Wide open three for Steph. And then his next three after that was in transition. Andre screened for Steph out of an early green post-up. And again, Ibaka did not switch out early enough. He was late. Steph faked him, did the flyby, and then turned around and looked at him as the shot was going through the net.
The other one that I wanted to talk about, which was actually a little bit before that, was they ran a double high, got it to Draymond on the short roll, and Serge Ibaka went to help on the drive and left Harrison Barnes wide open for three, and it was just...
Yeah, but it was totally contained already.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't a good help. Like, he didn't help enough, and that was right after the Bogut dunk. He didn't help enough on that one, and then he overhelped on off of the strong side corner. Although it was after a ball reversal, which makes it a little bit more difficult. But still, like, Green was contained. You want him taking, you know, a tough two. KD was right there. It wouldn't have been a problem. And instead, Ibaka just left Barnes. And then you saw they called timeout afterwards, and you could see KD yelling at him and, like, motioning out to the corner, like, get out there, you know?
Yeah.
I thought another key factor in this one was the Thunder supporting players outside of their big three. We can kind of put Adams in that really more than Ibaka at this point. Did nothing in this one. Deion Waiters regressed 3 for 11 he was 3 out of 9 in the first three quarters, which was really, you know, what is worth looking at in this game since it was garbage time. In the fourth, 1 out of 3 on threes, wasn't really able to get great shots, took some bad ones where he missed open guys. Russell Westbrook had 12 assists, and the rest of the team had 5 during that period, which is usually about how it works. Enes Kanter had a stretch in the late first and early second where he got scored on literally every single possession, where he was just switching or, you know, was at the rim and just wasn't able to help adequately or fouled or whatever it was when Adams was out and even when he was in. Also, that didn't help much. Robertson didn't go 3 for 3. He was 2 out of 5. Ibaka was 1 out of 5, just totally unengaged, which, you know, because he never gets a touch, that's kind of part of it. So it was, those guys just did not come through well enough. Randy Foy didn't score. He hit a couple of threes in the first game, I think, or at least one. So they got nothing out of anyone other than KD, who had 27, and Russell Westbrook, who had 11 of their 68 points through three quarters.
And Kanter only played 14 minutes in the first three quarters of this game. And yeah, the Warriors have done a great job getting him out. But when Steven Adams has the maladies that he had in this game, and he still played over 30 minutes, he played actually almost 31 in those 36 minutes, it's remarkable that he Kanter went from being such a huge factor to being a non-factor. But I think that's what both of us expected.
Just in general, I thought a key factor too is just the Warriors having greater intensity, getting more deflections, getting the loose balls more, obviously what they're able to do on the offensive glass, partially which is because of the fact that they're missing a lot of layups or getting penetration and putting the Thunder defense in flux. So that was a big part of what they were able to do too. And I guess we should say that the crowd was a lot better tonight. It was back to, you know, not unbelievable.
With one
but
exception.
At least, yeah. What was that?
That nobody reached out to try to catch Stephen Curry when he jumped into the crowd, which actually did bother me. I mean, it is from what I understand from where it happened, it is kind of a thing. Like, nobody could have, like, jumped in the way, but just, like, put your arms out.
It's really weird being on the side, too. Like, it'll happen every once in a while when you're just kind of sitting there, and they come at you, and you're like, all right, am I just, like, supposed to be a part of the scenery here? Do I catch them? Like, what do I do? And so I don't know. That kind of happened pretty quick. It's hard to catch him, especially when he, like, jumped over.
You're not, I just think put your arms out to try to break his fall. You're not going to catch him, but just to slow him down a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he could feel like he knows what's going to happen if he lands, and then you, like, kind of change the plan by, like, moving into his path. You know, I think I would much rather, as a terrified fan in that situation, just let him go than, like, get in his way and have that cause the injury. You know, it was anyway, that's really probably too ridiculous of a question to talk about any further. We're going to kind of go through just with some random observations through those first three quarters. But first, I want to tell you about our friends at Vistaprint. Vistaprint is a fantastic service for small businesses like my own. I have used them. They have a preliminary offer of 500 business cards for just $9.99 when you enter my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. And the reason it's so good for small business owners is basically your neighborhood print shop, but they have the price and the economy of scale of the big boys. And they offer a ton of custom products for your home or office, whether it's business cards, postcards, flyers, banners, apparel, invitations, whatever you want. It could be a coffee mug, anything that you want printed, you can get it printed by them at a fantastic price with fantastic service. So you can start off with them with those 500 business cards starting at just $9.99. Use that Capspace code at checkout. Don't forget about that, because that's how they know that you came from us, and hopefully they will then continue to advertise as well. And that'll give you up to 50% savings over your regular site pricing. Easy customization on those cards as well. I think you'll really enjoy their user interface if you give it a shot. And for only $9.99, there's no reason not to do that. So enter that code CAPSPACE at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, code CAPSPACE. So we'll pick it up in the first quarter. Again, Golden State just couldn't finish in the paint. Bogut had, I think, three turnovers right away where he just couldn't catch the ball. And, you know, you still wonder about how explosive he is with that groin injury. It probably will help him to get this time off. Steven Adams continued to be fantastic in transition defense. I think that may be sapping somewhat his effort on the offensive glass, and same thing with Cantor. That's been why Golden State has actually controlled the boards in these first two games. Maybe that, you know, it's just because every time Golden State gets it in transition, when they try for the offensive rebound and fail, you know, it seems like they can convert without those rim protectors there. So I always think that your bigs getting back is the key to transition defense. And Adams has done a great job of just running Steph off the line when he's coming up, and someone like Bogut is kind of hanging back after having gotten the rebound, and also just protecting the rim. He was fantastic. And the Warriors were double clutching. They weren't going up. They were trying extra passes that they turned over, really almost exclusively because of him.
Yeah, he was absolutely fantastic in this game, affecting everything and doing it despite his own limitations. And something else, we have to give him credit. Anderson Varejao did a reasonably good job in the first quarter.
Yeah, and he also was solid in the third during his stint. I mean, Kerr, really, if you think about it, he played five guys at center in this game during the relevant portion of the game, right? Azili, Varejao, Bogut, Green played a little bit of center, Spates, who actually got hurt a little bit on defense, but had an okay offensive game. So I think I'd like to ask him about this when I get a chance, but I think a lot of the idea, they've done that throughout the regular season, but Adams is playing 40 minutes in this series. You know, Ibaka is playing 35. Cantor can't stay on the floor for that long. So you're just, I think, going to be wearing these guys down, and that's a big part of their effort on the glass. And then another part is just that the smalls continue to gang rebound. There are a number of plays where it looked like the OKC big had their guy sealed, but when you seal a guy off, you are using your body to lean on him. You can't really jump. You're just sort of controlling space. So a smaller guy like Iguodala had a key rebound like this. Klay Thompson did too. If you fly in, even though you're not as big as that guy, you can still get the rebound because you can jump, and he can't because he's engaged with the defensive player.
Yeah, that's one of the ways that you can defensive rebound, and there's a lot of merit to it. I think it's Robin Lopez that's the one that's really good at that, right?
That's really good at boxing
right
out. Yeah, but I think even when that, I'm talking about situations where the offensive guy actually has position. Like that's a little, like,
yeah, that's
Robin,
that's
Lopez
different.
Yeah, he's good at helping his other bigs get rebounds by boxing out. But it's when, you know, that guy has to help, and now, you know, Cantor can get inside position, and that's when the wing coming in to jump over him, because he's not like, you know, a guy who's going to sky. He does it with effort. He does it with positioning. That's where it really helps. The play in the first quarter where Steph crossed up Cantor a bunch of times and hit a three, the crowd just started cheering as soon as it saw that Cantor was on Steph. That was pretty fantastic. And I thought Harrison Barnes has played pretty well. He's had pretty good D on KD individually. They've mixed it up on him. They've gone with Livingston. They've gone with Andre a fair amount. We haven't seen any Green on him because Green has been more focused on being a help defender and a rebounder. So, but Barnes did a nice job of setting some screens. He's hitting his corner threes. And just overall played a nice game, I thought.
I agree. He did a good job having a variety of roles defensively, which is something that he has to do. And also, I think he had three offensive rebounds in this game. It was two or three, which is also a nice thing for him just to show that he can be a little bit more assertive. And something that I noticed is that in game one, Barnes had, I think it was 17 shot contests, which shot contests generally, that's a good thing. You know, you want to have that. But I noted when I wrote the player-by-player breakdown for game one for The Athletic that Harrison Barnes is a guy you'd actually want him to contest less shots just because you don't want his guy shooting that many. And I think that went from 17 to 5 for game two.
Yeah, I think he spent a little bit less time on KD in this one, but did an okay job when he was there. Helped, of course, by the fact that when he was guarding KD, that's when Robertson was in the game and he had all kinds of help behind him. In the second quarter, Kerr went with the Kumbaya Kerr lineup, Barbosa, Livingston, Iguodala, Barnes, and Spates, so none of the big three. And that unit actually did okay and slightly extended the lead, even though they struggled a little bit. Spates had one of the most athletic plays I've ever seen from him, where he had a 15-foot fadeaway that he missed and then got up to tip that shot in before it hit the ground. That was pretty fantastic. Durant, however, was awesome in the second quarter. He got going with two wide-open three-pointers where the Warriors just did not pick him up in transition, may not have even known who they had and failed to communicate. And then, you know, overall, he was 10 out of 15 in those the relevant portion of the game. But he did have eight turnovers, and very many of those occurred when Robertson was on the floor with him, and he just did not have the spacing.
Yeah, you mentioned before about deflections, and one of the notable stats for me from this game, using the NBA Hustle stats, which is great now on their site, Iguodala had six deflections in this game, and the Thunder as a team had eight.
Yeah, they did not get that many. They did, you know, force some turnovers, and they were pretty good at the rim. But yeah, they did not have that much intensity. Some of their length was bothering them, but they really just were not able to play with any kind of force at all in that third quarter. And maybe they kind of ran out of gas a little bit by that point, just with the Warriors being so much deeper. In the first half, I think one other thing that's becoming apparent is, like, what do you think of the Thunder offense so far in this game? I think that Golden State feels pretty good about how they're defending them, as long as they just don't make the odd mental mistake.
Yeah, I mean, when they lost Durant twice in a row, that was pretty egregious, and actually might have galvanized their effort in terms of the second half, because I don't think they lost him at all in the third quarter. So I thought they did a pretty decent job, and their offense had been shaky, but then they used that, I think it was an 8-0 run to end the quarter, but defensively I thought they did a reasonable job in the first half.
Yeah, and even in game one I thought they were pretty decent. They gave up 108 points on 103 possessions. It was a crazy fast game. And then in this one, it was 44 possessions in the first half due to all the offensive rebounds, and they scored 57 points. The Thunder had 49 just due to KD going crazy, but then they only put up 19 in the third, and then early in the fourth continued to be totally unable to score. I think they only had 7 points through like the first half of the fourth quarter to put away any chance of a comeback. The other notable thing is that Golden State had 30 points on 22 possessions in the second quarter, and only three of those were from Steph or Klay.
Wow.
All right, anything else you got on this one before we move on to news?
Not really. I think we covered it pretty well. It was striking to see the Warriors. I mean, to me, this was their best all-around performance since, you know, from top to bottom for a game, let's say for the relevant portion, since the Houston series.
Yeah, that game one against the Blazers was pretty good, too, I suppose. But, yeah, you know, I think for me, I'm not sure what to think about for the rest of this series. I think that Golden State generally is going to bring it. I think if Oklahoma City brings their highest level defense, that these teams are pretty close to even, that maybe Golden State is slightly better once Curry can really kind of get going. And, you know, these games have been at home, obviously, for Golden State, too. We'll see what it looks like in Oklahoma City. And so the question is just going to be, can the Thunder avoid big defensive lapses like they did in that third quarter? And, you know, also, are they going to be able to, like, start asserting themselves on the glass again, which has not really been as much of a factor. Golden State's done a great job there. But, yeah, it's that Thunder defense and their communication. If they can keep that up, if guys like Ibaka and Adams can continue switching out, force Golden State to drive, bother their shots at the rim, that's a blueprint to where they're going to do okay. Because I don't think the Thunder are really just going to blow up on this Warriors team. I think their offense is just not sophisticated enough, and they're just going to have to hope that KD and Russ can hit tough shots, and sometimes they will and sometimes they won't. But either way, you're not going to have just a blow them out offensive performance against this Warriors team, I don't think.
Yeah, well, you could argue that it could go marginally one direction or the other. Something I thought about on the drive home was that the first two games represented the, you know, kind of the two different logical ways that the games in this series can go. You know, the Thunder play really well and get what was for the most part a close win, a respectable win. They did a nice job. And then when the Warriors are on, they'll win comfortably. And, you know, that they could, if they play as well as they did tonight, they can win in Oklahoma City without, you know, without too much of a problem, though I think they'll have a great crowd. So
yeah, I mean, I anticipate it's going to be a split there.
So do I.
But, you know, the Thunder are certainly capable. I mean, they are a team that oftentimes has gotten better throughout the course of the series in their history as well. We've talked about how Golden State does that. And this is a game that obviously Golden State had to have from a desperation standpoint. This is somewhat of a predictable outcome. And it's really hard for me to imagine the Thunder getting blown out at home. You know, I think this is going to be really, and it's hard for me to imagine the Warriors fully healthy getting blown out either. So I think these are going to be two really tough, close games that could go either way in these next couple of games.
Going from a predictable outcome to an entirely unpredictable outcome, the Knicks hired Jeff Hornacek.
And moreover, it appears that he is not going to be asked to run the triangle. He's never coached the triangle before. I will be very interested to see once he actually does get hired. Howard Beck tweeted that they will hire him. Ken Berg then said that contract negotiations haven't begun, but there seems to be an acknowledgement that he's Phil's guy. They were spotted by the New York Daily News in a fantastic photo and headline coming out of a restaurant near Central Park. Steve Mills, the Knicks kind of GM, and then Phil Jackson with the headline, "Do I Make You Horny?" It's going to be some fantastic fodder for the New York tabloids. But if indeed this hire does end up happening, which all indications are that it will, what do you think of it?
I think it's a better hire than I expected. You know, I had for a long time just kind of couched it in the idea of that they were going to run the triangle and they were going to do that. So there were numerous coaches, including Frank Vogel, who I think personally is the best coach on the market for most of these teams, that I just kind of took out of the running in my own brain. And to see them go with Hornacek, who on the aggregate, I think did a very good job with Phoenix. He lost the locker room a little bit this year, and I don't completely blame him for that. Just it was a tough locker room, and sometimes you're going to lose those guys. So I think he did a good job. The players played hard for him that first year with the Suns in particular, and he seems to be a bright, creative guy for me. So I don't think you have to necessarily say, oh, well, he did X with the Suns. And this is actually something Chris Herring mentioned in his Wall Street Journal piece, that drawing conclusions from what he did in Phoenix might be flawed because that Phoenix team had specific strengths that are substantially different from the Knicks.
Well, one strength that they did have in common, at least his 2014 team, was Channing Frye and Kristaps Porzingis. I think that one of the absolute hardest things to stop in basketball is a big who can pick and pop for three and then is also big enough that you can't just switch on him because he can take you down in the post. And I expect Porzingis to come back stronger so that he can be more effective down in the post. And the Knicks, I mean, we remember that game at Oracle that we saw in person. They did not run a single pick and pop for Kristaps Porzingis the entire game under Rambis. And so that if Hornacek utilizes that skill, which I think he will, now they're going to need like someone who can actually run a pick and roll on this team. And there are not really any point guards on the market who are going to be great at that for them, as we'll get to. But at the very least, I think that we'll see some more of that from the Knicks and that'll be good. I'll tell you what a thought that occurred to me. I mean, I have no reason, no source information to think this. But the first thing that occurred to me was this hire means that Phil knows he's leaving after a year and realized that it would be wrong to, especially with, I'm sure, some discussions with Jim Dolan, that it would be wrong to saddle the Knicks with another triangle coach and then he was just going to leave because there is, remember, a mutual opt-out for the Knicks and for Phil at the end of this season.
And we know how mutual options turn out.
Yes, somebody always takes them because you're never going to be in the exact same situation of value as you were when the contract was agreed to. So someone's always going to opt out. You would imagine, depending on how this years ago, that it might be the Knicks and that Phil, or Phil maybe if he wants to return to LA, depending on how things go with the Lakers. It still could be in flux. Maybe he'll stick around. I'm not certain about this, but for whatever reason, I would love to know what Phil says about why he went this way after basically saying, hey, we're going to be running the triangle. He had this ballyhooed training camp on the triangle for a bunch of the Knicks players as well after the season, which is somewhat unprecedented. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to hear what the rationale is when, in fact, Phil talks to the media about Jeff Hornacek. I suppose he's just going to say, hey, he's just was so good that we just had no choice but to take him, and you know, if we don't run the triangle, fine.
Yeah, and I think he could be a nice coach for them in terms of a sales pitch. We talked about this a little bit with Walton. Of course, Walton's younger and has a different relationship with players, but coaches in New York, you want to run a style of basketball that players will want to play, and I think that will be something for Hornacek as this team eventually becomes a team with a little bit more cap space and a little bit more flexibility that is more appealing than they would have been if they were running something a little bit more stale.
Yeah, and if I were a free agent point guard, of which there are very many in the summer of 2017, with a coach like Hornacek, who I hope will be willing to run plenty of pick and pop, you see what point guards who play with Dirk are able to do. Porzingis could someday have that effect, although he has not proven to be quite that level of pure shooter yet. The hope is that he'll get there, similar to Dirk. Then I think they could become very appealing to some of those marquee point guards in the summer of 2017. The Chicago Bulls have dismissed a couple of people in their training operation. Jen Swanson, who famously worked with Derrick Rose on his ACL rehab and was brought in as someone that he trusted, has been dismissed. And then they also dismissed their strength coach. They still have the same training staff, but I think this is part of a understanding that they just have been too injured, that they need to have a fresh approach. And, you know, the Bulls, I think, have, and not that it's all the training staff's fault or even, you know, the strength coach or whatever, but I think they do need a new direction, because they have really the two things that make you think that a training staff is not doing that well. One is repeated injuries to players of the same body part, and then the other one is muscle injuries that happen a lot and then, of course, happen again. You know, those are the two kind of things that I think are most preventable, and the Bulls have certainly struggled in those areas traditionally.
Yeah, well, it would be nice to have a season where we don't have to talk about Aaron Brooks' hamstring injuries all the time.
Little Kings news, according to Zach Lowe in his piece he wrote about the lottery yesterday, and then as also mentioned by James Hamm, the Kings are cooling on the idea of re-signing Rajon Rondo, another tidbit that kind of goes into what we're talking about here with the free agent point guards after this. But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I think they want him back, but it seems like they're not going to be planning on breaking the bank if there's a bidding war. That to me means annual salary kind of around what he was making last year, maybe a little bit of a raise, you know, because they'll be able to give him 120% of what he was making last year. That's what his cap hold is going to be. And I would guess that they probably don't want to necessarily go beyond that. Then the other one is that Seth Curry and James Anderson actually have both officially opted out. Curry, another guy that we'll talk about in a little bit in the next segment. James Anderson, I am surprised that he opted out. It would surprise me if he got guaranteed money from anyone else next year.
Yeah, that definitely surprises me. And with the Rondo news, I'm encouraged, just because it looked like one of those scenarios like what we'll see with the Clippers and Jeff Green, where the team painted themselves into a corner and just kind of had that obligation. But as optimistic as I am, I'll believe it when I see it when it comes to the Sacramento leverages.
All right, let's get to our free agent rankings now. The way that I usually like to do this is I'll categorize players into superstar, star, starter, rotation, and then kind of fringe, end of the bench guys that you wouldn't necessarily want on your rotation in a good team. And for the point guards, not that many of them this year. We talked about how it's not an amazing class. We'll just kind of go through, and Danny will tell me whether he agrees or disagrees with my rankings. We'll talk about the age, obviously, which is probably your number one variable, since we all kind of know what these guys are doing right now, but you want to project out over the life of a contract. And the real variable that I tried to stick to as best I could in these rankings was to look at who I thought would get or deserve the biggest contracts over the amount of years that they're going to get. In some cases, maybe with older guys who are going to, for a team that might win now, I ranked them ahead of some younger guys who might get a larger contract over 4 years, just because the more veteran guys are worth more in that first or second year. But let's get started. Do you agree with me, Danny, that there are no players who fall under the superstar category in this point guard class?
I do. I mean, there just isn't that guy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And when you want to talk about the definition of a star or a superstar or whatever, that's obviously pretty fluid. But to me, a superstar is one of those guys who I look at as, if you put the right talent around him, this could be the best player on a championship team. And Mike Conley is in the star category for me next. He's the only one there. 28 years old. This will be his first time getting into free agency since he signed an extension that was ridiculed at the time. I think 5 years, $45 million, and then actually under the old CBA, and then actually became what was a great value contract at $9 million a year or so for the Grizz. Would you put him in that star category as well?
I would for now, and that is the challenge with this, is that he's at that level right now. He will be paid at that level, but 3 years from now, I'm dubious. When I wrote the Chris Paul piece, part of what I was keying on is that smaller point guards do not generally age well. There are, of course, exceptions to that, and that, of course, is a concern for Conley.
Age 28 for Conley, And he is very likely going to be offered an absolute maximum contract by the Grizzlies. That contract, since he's in the 7 to 9 year experience level, he'll have 7.5% annual raises. And they, of course, are the only ones who can offer him the fifth year. If he goes elsewhere, only 4.5% annual raises and only 4 years. So the contract that the Grizzlies would offer him would be 5 years, $149.5 million. That would pay him $33.8 million in the 2021 season when he is 32. That is going to be an awful contract by the end of it. But for a Grizzlies team that still has some outstanding draft obligation, is probably not ready to tank and rebuild anyway, I think they're just going to go ahead and offer it to him regardless.
I think they will. I have a difference of opinion with that idea just because I don't think the surplus value is that high, but that's a discussion we'll have another time.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that we're going to need to wrap our heads around, and I agree with you. It's going to be a bad contract at the end, but you can also say, well, what is the alternative? Like, if you need to come up with, and Conley's contract will start at $25.6 million. His cap hold also is going to be smaller than that, 150% of what he's making this year, so that's about $15 million. So they can actually get effectively almost $11 million of extra space by re-signing him last, just keeping his cap hold on the books and then signing him. So that's another thing, too, and they can maybe make some additions to the team. But, yeah, I mean, what is your plan other than just re-signing him? That's the question. Now, certainly over the next 2 years, what do you do with that money? No idea. And we'll talk more about this on the Grizzlies season preview. I don't want to get too much in the weeds here. But, yeah, I expect that they are going to offer him that maximum and that fifth year of almost $34 million when he would be lucky to get, you know, even still be a starter probably, or at least a high-end starter by that point, may be too much for him to pass up. And then if he signs with another team, presumably that would take the max as well, too. And that would be a four-year, $111 million contract if he were to sign elsewhere. I mean, I think we agree that's going to be a bad contract, but everyone's going to be a bad contract. I think just the difference with that is, you know, that fifth year could be really bad. That fourth year could be really bad for him.
One other thing I'll mention before we spend too much time on Conley is that a 3+1 also has the possibility that he might actually opt out of that last year just to get security if he's a little bit higher level at age 31. And so you could actually see the difference between a 3-year contract and a 5-year contract with the way it could work out.
Yeah, and again, with things being so overheated this year, expect to see a lot of the things that we saw last year. Player options on the last year of these contracts, 15% trade kickers on these contracts, which with the cap going up will be relevant even for the guys who are getting maxed out, which it often wouldn't be because you can't have more than the maximum salary. In past years, the cap wouldn't go up that high, so you'd have a trade of a guy with a 15% trade kicker. He's already making the max, so it didn't matter. Now it will because the cap's going up even higher. All right, the starters category, I only had two in this, and starters is kind of being generous, frankly, especially with the ages of these guys. These are not guys who you bring them in and you're like, oh, hey, we're set at this position for the next 3 or 4 years. That's what you normally would want to have when you're kind of paying starter money to a player in free agency. But Deron Williams has a player option at age 32. He said he's going to opt out of that. And then Rajon Rondo, age 30, his one-year contract with the Kings is expiring. What do you think of those two guys?
They should both be among the 30 best point guards in the league next year, so that means that they are starter quality in that sense. And the challenge is years and dollars. Like, if I were a GM, I would be more comfortable giving them more money for a shorter time period just so it's not an albatross, but that might not be what they want.
Yeah, I agree with you there. Williams is going to be coming back to the Mavs. Both of these teams, incumbent teams, will have to use cap space on them because they are just not really, you know, they've only been on the team for 1 year, so there's no bird rights. And that could mean that they'd be more likely to change teams. I mean, Deron is from Dallas. He's already getting paid by the Nets, so I think there's more of a chance necessarily that he's back. And Rajon Rondo in Sacramento, DeMarcus Cousins apparently really loves him. We'll see what Dave Joerger thinks of him. Joerger at least has gotten some offense out of some pretty shooting challenge lines. I mean, that's the big problem with Rondo is just, yeah, individually he's a talented player and he can pass the ball. His defense was horrible last year. Maybe he'd get better, but he hasn't been a good defender now in, ever since the ACL injury. So you wonder about the fit, even if he himself is kind of a talented player. And, you know, if other than a 1-year deal, maybe 2 years. I'm probably not that interested in these guys, but there also are a lot of teams that could really use point guards out there. And I think Williams, I prefer Williams over Rondo, even though he's older. But then also you worry that Williams always gets hurt, and he really probably should really only be playing about 25 minutes a game at this point. So neither of those guys are really particularly perfect options. And given their ages, I would not want to really commit to them for anything longer than 1 year, ideally maybe two. But again, this is a totally overheated market. Teams need point guards. But also there's a great point guard market next year. So that's something to consider as well. So maybe where you end up with either of these guys is you really just overpay them for 1 year, which isn't the end of the world, because a lot of these teams probably are going to have more space than you know what to do with anyway.
There are two other individuals that I think should be considered for this, though I probably wouldn't have either of them in this tier, and that is Jeremy Lin on the present sense. I think he could be one of the 30 best point guards in the league next year, and eventually Jordan Clarkson, who I consider more of a two, but could still be in this conversation because he can defend either position.
Yeah, you know, I was going through just the unrestricted guys first, but yeah, we probably should talk about Clarkson. I think, yeah, he definitely is someone that I would consider a starter because he will be 24 when the season starts. I think he has athleticism. He showed a burgeoning three-point stroke. If he gets on a real team, I don't see why he wouldn't be able to defend. He's pretty athletic. He just hasn't had any kind of defensive coaching so far or talent around him. He is a restricted free agent, though, and he is limited by the Gilbert Arenas rule, which means that opposing teams outside of the Lakers can only offer him $5.6 million to start in the first 2 years, and then they could actually max him out for the next 2 years, and it would count on their cap as the average of those 3 or 4 years if you wanted to go that far. The Lakers almost certainly would match any offer for him because his cap hold is tiny. It would behoove them to do that. And the other reason is because if you are the matching team, it counts differently on your cap than if you are the team that made the offer. If you are the matching team, then he just counts at what he's actually being paid. So he would count at $5.6 million this year, then a little bit raise above that next year when the Lakers also hope to be active in free agency with the cap going up again. And then he would count at the max in 2018 and 2019. Now, that wouldn't be the max at that time. It would be this year's max. So I actually think that the Lakers would welcome an offer from another team that would allow them to pay him so little. And, you know, there's going to be so much money out there. So many teams need point guards. We may see a team do that anyway, especially because you're not doing anything else with your cap space. At least curry some favor with his agent, if nothing else.
Agreed on all counts. And I think it's best for the Lakers. And also it's notable that the Lakers cannot offer him that structure of contract outside of this method of doing it, because you can't just give a guy, even if they're allowed to do it with another team, they can't just say, hey, let's agree to 5-5 and then 20. Like, that's not something that they're allowed to do. And if you want an example to tie this to reality, the guy who you can use is the player who signed this contract prominently most recently, which is the other guy I considered for starters, Jeremy Lin.
Yeah, Lin, but he, of course, the Knicks did not match, and he ended up going to the Rockets, and then he counted as, just an average of, I think it was $8.3 million over the 5 years that he was
three
there.
Years.
Thank you. Yes. And so Lin is 27. He has a player option. He signed for the biannual. He's absolutely going to opt out of that. I think, you know, something like the figures that have been bandied about for him have been, you know, even getting into eight figures a year. You know, this at 27, this is probably his last chance at getting a big deal. He's a guy who I think can start for you in a pinch. You know, I agree with you that he's kind of close to the starter level. Clarkson, I just put up there for sure for me, just because he's that much younger and, you know, also a little bit more athletic than Lin is. And I think Lin is, as we saw in the playoffs, he can be really effective going against second units when the opposing point guard isn't that good or is smaller than him. You don't have that great of a pick and roll defender, you know, the way he killed Amari Stoudemire in that series, for example. But then when you really get good rim protection, or you get a guy when he was being guarded by Josh Richardson or Justice Winslow, he couldn't do anything at all. And so I think he is someone, more than a lot of players, who has just more effectiveness as a backup than he does as a starter. And I would not feel, especially with him at 27, he might have just had his best year too. I wouldn't feel amazing about, oh, this guy is our starting point guard, let's give him a $15 million a year contract for the next 4 years.
He is also somebody worth watching because it appears, we don't know for sure, but it appears that he probably took less money for a good situation in Charlotte, which worked out very well for him. And there are a lot more considerations than just the financial terms of it. And there will be vastly different circumstances for somebody like Jeremy Lin. You know, you could get a starting job somewhere where he'd be put in a position where he might not succeed, or he could be put in a smaller role in a better situation. situation that might be better for him. And so he's somebody who I actually think could be willing to not all the way cash out if the money is, let's say, close.
Yeah, someone who also has made a fair amount already in his career, has made some good money from endorsements. I mean, I think he probably would like to get the keys to a team one last time and see. I don't know if that job is out there for him. The other interesting thing to watch here is because, again, he was only on the team for 1 year in Charlotte, and then they are probably not going to have cap space if they're going to re-sign Batum, re-sign Marvin Williams. I think those guys would be the priorities. I would prioritize Lynn over Al Jefferson, perhaps. But, and they also might even try to bring in a free agent big, might even be more of a priority than Lynn as well. So I think Lynn is definitely going to be gettable. It would very much surprise me if Charlotte were willing to pay as much as some other teams that really need more of a solution, because Charlotte already has Kemba Walker and they're paying him on a good value contract the rest of the time. All right, so let's run through sort of the rest of this. This is still the rotation tier now. I've got seven more guys in this. I'll just run through them real quickly, and you can tell me which of the guys you like the most. This is my ordering of these guys. Brandon Jennings, age 26. Grievous Vasquez, age 29. Austin Rivers, age 23. He has a player option that he'll almost certainly not exercise. He's making, I think, in the mid-threes next year. Ramon Sessions, age 30. DJ Augustin, age 28. Ish Smith, age 27. And Raymond Felton, age 32.
I definitely like Jennings the best of that group. Of course, his injury scares me, but I think he has the most talent and also showed a fair amount this year when he was able to play. And, I mean, Vasquez is probably second also on my list, even though he was hurt so much of this year, because, again, he's more talented.
And when I talk about these rotation guys, I think that, you know, Rivers being 23, he actually wasn't that bad this year. You know, we like to make fun of him. I think he took some steps forward for sure. He's someone who at least can create a shot for you, which has some value, even if he's not necessarily going to make it efficiently. Shot better from three. I think his individual defense is improving. I didn't see as many lapses from him this year as you saw when he first came to the Clippers, just in terms of his effort and attention level. And the fact that he's 23 as well, you have to imagine he will be returning to the Clippers and they will have full bird rights on him, so they can pay him kind of whatever. So I wouldn't expect him to be going anywhere. But, you know, you could make an argument just because of his age that over the longer term, you might want him more than any of these other guys, because none of these guys are really that sexy to me.
Austin Rivers is a good example of one of the through lines that I see through this point guard group, which is that there are a lot of players who are talented individuals, and like Zach LaVine might be better being off the ball or as a secondary ball handler, but defend point guards. So how you value that is also really challenging, because if you have somebody like Austin, I would rather have somebody else who's capable of ball handling, but there just aren't that many people in the league.
What if we're talking about for just next year? You're a team that desperately needs a backup point guard. Which of these guys would you most want to have on your team? Outside of Lynn, who's clearly, I think, the best. Which of these guys do you most want to have on your team for just next year?
Brandon Jennings.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, we're really just, you know, Felton has conditioning issues. He's 32. Ish Smith can't shoot. DJ Augustin can't play any defense and, you know, had some really bad times in Oklahoma City before looking better with Denver. Vasquez can't defend anybody either. I mean, he's 6'5", and he's also 29. Yeah, I guess it is Jennings. I mean, these guys all just have massive question marks, so to where, I mean, I would say even, and Vasquez is coming off an injury, maybe even Sessions is the guy, but he can't stop anybody either. But he's the guy who is kind of the lowest downside, because I think that's sort of important with a backup point guard too, is, all right, we just need to have some kind of a solution, because just having nobody at backup point guard can just destroy your bench no matter who else you have, unless you have someone else who can kind of initiate the offense.
Like Brandon Jennings' old team.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. It's a rough group here. All right, let's go down to the guys who are kind of more on the fringe here. I'll just read off these names. Mo Williams, Ty Lawson, Shane Larkin, Aaron Brooks, who's 31, Brian Roberts is 30, Kirk Heinrich, 35, Jason Terry, 38, Jordan Farmar, 29, Donald Sloan, 28. And Mo Williams is 33, Ty Lawson, 28.
I like Larkin and Brooks the best of this group. You know, Larkin has potential, only 23. Brooks had a pretty solid year for Chicago.
Yeah, you always think he's doing it with smoke and mirrors. He also is another guy who's just absolutely horrendous. But he does have the advantage that he can at least shoot, and you can't leave him. Brian Roberts, another kind of one of those guys. I mean, at this point, you're getting to either just all offense guys. Ty Lawson clearly has the highest upside, I think, of that group, maybe with Larkin behind him just because he's way younger after getting his rookie option declined. signed with the Knicks, and now I think he has with the Nets, I think he has a player option this year, although I might have forgotten to put that in. I'm not sure. But none of these guys are amazing. You're not feeling good with any of these guys as your backup point guard. Lawson was awful in the playoffs. He has the alcoholism problems that by some accounts he hasn't entirely kicked yet. And he's 28, the age at which those kind of point guards fall off. So again, it just, there is not a lot of certainty, steadiness on this market to just get, you know, all I want is just, all right, a guy who can run an okay pick and roll and like not get killed defensively. And there's, you know, maybe two of those guys out there outside of that starter group. It's pretty ugly.
If I were a European point guard, I would consider trying to make the jump this year.
Yeah, and actually, Nando DeColo, who just had an unbelievable EuroLeague, I unfortunately did not get a chance to watch that yet, but he is probably at this point the best point guard playing outside of the U.S. The Raptors actually have his restricted free agent rights, although he is not a great fit there when they already have DeLon Wright, they already have Corey Joseph coming off the bench. So maybe a sign and trade with him is something that you could look at. Sergio Rodriguez, another guy, and I don't know exactly what these guys' buyout situations are either, but with all the cap space around the league, you can get to the point where you can maybe pay these guys' buyouts, still pay them $5-7 million a year. I would, Sergio Yule, another guy, the Rockets still have his draft rights, would probably be better than any of these guys except for Lynn. And Yule and DeColo at least, you know, have NBA athleticism. They can defend. Rodriguez, not a guy who's a good defender. We should talk about the restricted guys too on this, and they look a little bit better, I think, than some of these kind of rotation guys who are unrestricted.
Yeah, and these are players that also fit into that, what I was talking about with Rivers, is guys that I don't necessarily love them stewarding an offense full time, but Matthew Dellavedova, of course, very talented player, gritty defender, hits open threes, which is a nice combination and perfect for Cleveland. He's only 25. Langston Galloway, I'm not completely sold on him as a primary ball handler, but still talented at 24. And Tyler Johnson, another guy, perfect fit for his current team as the kind of off guy with both Dragic and Dwayne Wade at 24 years old.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Both Galloway and Johnson, I think of them as pretty similar. Galloway, maybe a little better shooter. Johnson, a little bit more hops. They're both pretty decent defensive tools. And let's start with Dellavedova. His cap hold, again, will be pretty small. He will be restricted, but he's not Arenas now. This is all his third year in the league. So other teams can offer him pretty much anything. The Cavs can match. And, you know, that's going to get into Dan Gilbert's wallet again, although now that they don't have to pay Timofey Mozgov, that he's kind of out of the rotation, I think their luxury tax bill won't be as bad anymore. So I think the Cavs probably will match anything that's not just completely exorbitant. And with Mo Williams not really having worked out there, struggling with injuries all year, I mean, they really need him for next year. And given the other options, they'll have no way to replace him. I would be shocked if they don't match, you know, unless it's something completely crazy like $15 million a year starter money. But yeah, I mean, that's going to be more money out of Dan Gilbert's pocket. I think Dellavedova is probably going to get paid. I wouldn't want to pay him more than maybe $8 or $9 million a year. And that, even that is a lot, you know, as a guy who can sort of be a decent stopgap for you as a starter at times, and then, you know, come off the bench. Also tough enough to defend twos at times, gritty, can play off the ball because he can shoot threes, runs a pick and roll okay, but he also runs that with LeBron James and a ton of shooting around him, so I'd like to see how he looks at that. You know, he really struggled last year against good defenses, like in the finals, once, you know, the Cavs didn't have as much firepower. So I think he looks a lot better because he's on the Cavs, but he also could be a candidate to get overpaid just because of the lack of other options.
Yeah, I think that's all a good point.
Yeah. On the fringe, I really like Seth Curry. We talked about him as a restricted free agent with Sacramento. Sacramento would have to eat into either their cap space or their mid-level exception, but they'll probably be using cap space. They will not be over the cap. They would have to use cap space to re-sign him. Curry is a player with 3 years of experience, so he will not be limited by the Arenas provision to get $5.6 million from another team. And I could see, and he's also almost certainly going to opt out of his player option, so I could see another team, you know, maybe paying him a reasonable amount that the Kings would not be interested in matching with their cap space. They might think that they can go in another direction. And I like Curry because he showed some pretty good pick and roll ability, both playing in the summer league with the Pelicans last year and then down the end of this year. And then he can shoot the ball, not really much of a defensive player, but another guy who can play off the ball a little bit for you too, and at least a guy who has some upside still at age 25.
Yeah, I like him a lot. I like him the best of the kind of fringy players, but he hasn't proven himself a rotation guy yet, so I think he's appropriately in that tier, but I like him the best of that tier.
Another interesting candidate for if you just need someone to run a pick and roll, it's all he can do. Marcelino Huertas, who is actually 33 now, a longtime Brazilian stalwart, would have loved to have seen what he could have done in the league 5 years earlier. But if you just, hey, we need someone who can create something, he is a pick and roll maestro, maybe the least athletic player in the league at the guard position, you know, has some really hopeless shots, you know, one footers where he'll just, you know, look completely out of place in the NBA from an athleticism standpoint. But the man can run a pick and roll. And if you have some defense around him and you give him a decent role man, you know, I think he could actually prop up some second unit offense. Another guy who I think of, I mean, yeah, he's 33, but he could at least have a little bit of upside to kind of run things for you on the second unit. And then the other two kind of fringier restricted free agents, Isaiah Kanan, 24, a guy who doesn't really have point guard skills, terrible defensively, but can shoot the crap out of the ball. And then Tim Frazier, who showed something in his cameo with New Orleans down the end of the year. He's sort of like, I think of him as almost like just a slightly younger Ish Smith. Got some point guard skills, athletic, can defend, but is not going to be able to shoot the ball from three-point range much. Again, a guy that you could bring in, maybe hope that he can grow into the role, but if you sign him, you're not like, all right, backup point guard's taken care of for sure.
Something small to watch with Cannon is that the potential of Philly drafting Ben Simmons, a guy who can theoretically run the offense, could actually help him, though you don't expect Simmons to play a lot with second units. But the reason that Simmons and players like that are so valuable is that you can play an Isaiah Cannon without having the downside.
Yeah, other than his defense, which is going to be
well, that's the difference between him and like Dellavedova, who is, you know, a much, 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 much better defender. Like if Cannon was what Deli was on that end, he would be a clear NBA player.
So it sounds like we agree pretty much on these classifications. Is there anyone that you feel like the league might value a lot differently than you and I are personally valuing them here?
I think Dellavedova might get money, especially because a couple of the teams are a couple of these guys that are interesting are Arenas Limited, Galloway, Johnson, and Clarkson. So he's young-ish like those guys, and he hasn't been in the league that long, so people might think he's younger than he is. And he's done a really good job with what he's been asked to do. And those are players sometimes, especially when they're on successful teams, that somebody goes, oh, they can do that for us. They can bring that grit and they can do that. So I wouldn't be shocked if somebody offered him $10 million a year.
Yeah, and he's a high character guy, good locker room guy. You know he's going to be a good teammate, fit in, be okay with his role. And also to get him away from the Cavs, you know it's going to take a pretty exorbitant offer. So that would not shock me.
Oh, also Vasquez. Vasquez was traded for a first-round pick a year ago in a trade that dumbfounded both of us. But whenever somebody gets traded for something way more valuable than I think, I just assume that they have more value in the league than I expect.
Yeah, maybe that's the case as well. You could see maybe even Rondo as well, although the Kings were so bad. If the Kings had just made the playoffs and he played exactly the same as he did, I think he would be like really, really in demand for some teams. But yeah, I don't know. It'll be very, very interesting to me whether Sacramento brings him back, because they have to eat into their cap space to do it. And they still have Darren Collison under contract pretty reasonably as an okay stopgap next year. Thanks so much for listening. That'll do it for today. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Obviously, I'm live tweeting quite a bit during these games. Danny is Danny LaRue. Everyone who gives us a review on iTunes or even just a rating, which takes almost no time at all, that's really helped us in the rankings, helps us get some more listeners, which we appreciate. We also appreciate y'all telling your friends. So if you get a chance, do that or retweets, whatever it is. This is the big time for the NBA, obviously, a great time for us to get new listeners. And anything you guys can do to help with that, we really appreciate it. We will be back tomorrow night. Talk to y'all then.